McCartney fans, and welcome to episode 103 of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of Paul McCartney. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and you may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast where we talk all things solo Beatles. And as always, I am joined by my buddy, my friend, my backwards traveler, Mr. Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on?
Didn't I just see you last night?
Yes.
I'm doing well. I'm doing well, Tom. Thanks.
You got it, my friend. You got it. Thanks for being here again. And as you can see, we have another guest with us today. He is a Grammy Award-winning guitar legend. His work can be heard in films, TV shows, video games, and oh yeah, with this little group called Wings. He is the one and only Lawrence Juber. Hello, Lawrence, and welcome to the show.
Hey.
Thank you for being here. You know, and he's also got one of the greatest smiles in rock and roll, so thank you for that. And I also got to say, speaking of smiles, all the smiles on our faces while you're doing the Tea Time with LJ, you know, throughout the year has just been a pleasure. So thank you very much for,
I'm glad to get that. Yeah.
It was very much appreciated. So on behalf of all the fans, you know, you really knocked it out of the park on those shows. So. But first, things first, let's get started with this little picture that it's behind the CD of the LJ Plays the Beatles. And it's this guy here. I hope you can see it.
So if you can
tell us about LJ at that age, what was going on there? And
I'm age 13 and I'm actually singing yesterday.
No kidding.
Because that was 13. I turned 13 in 1965.
Okay. Yeah. So in your bio, you talked about, you know, that's the Beatles or your inspiration for picking up a guitar. Is that correct?
To a large extent, not exclusively. Okay. 1963 was really, I mean, that was kind of as Beatlemania started to develop right. in England. But there were a lot of other bands. I mean, the Shadows in particular.
Sure. Right.
Yeah.
They were really, you know, they were very big. You know, Apache mm-hmm. was a big hit, and, you know, that kind of twangy guitar sound really appealed to me.
Gotcha.
And I was inspired to play, but I kind of nagged my parents for most of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the thing that kind of tipped the scales, because my dad wanted me to play the saxophone.
Oh.
I'll play clarinet in school and then make it at the bottom of the list. So
right, gotcha.
Clarinets before they got to me.
Yeah, so you did have support from your family to play instruments then?
Well, I mean, they weren't musical. Okay. So the idea of playing an instrument, you know, it was fine. I mean, it's just that my dad was a fan of big bands. But then, you know, Beatles go on the Royal Command performance and became, you know, kind of very legit.
Mm-hmm.
Very quickly, and you know, that was right around the time I got my first guitar on my 11th birthday. And But She Loves You had come out in August of that year, and that really, I think that part of it was that motivated me that much more, because that was a big hit. And you know, of that progression of Please Please Me, From Me to You, She Loves You, and then I Want to Hold Your Hand was just kind of this big wave of kind of Beatle wellness, you know. And of course, in England, we didn't have that Ed Sullivan moment.
Right.
It was a progression throughout that period.
Got you. So did the playing come natural to you?
Up to a point. I mean, I've always had to, I've never been a technician. I've been mostly self-taught.
Okay.
Music came naturally to me.
Mm. Gotcha.
Playing is just, you know, there's just a lot of practice, and a lot of study and understanding. And I got pretty good at faking it.
Oh, really?
Style, you know, because just love the range of musical styles and the idea that I could play kind of whatever I wanted to, I just had to apply myself to it.
Gotcha.
And then when I was 13, there was a local band leader who started taking me out playing like weddings and stuff.
So yeah,
I learned a lot on the bandstand, learned how to listen.
Right. And because there's a lot of info out there about you, and you really don't know what's true and what's not true. So let's just play a little Wikipedia fact or fiction here. So you started earning money as a musician at 13. True or false?
Yeah. No, that's true. Okay. No, I made a bit more than babysitting and washing my neighbor's car.
Certainly more enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I got to play guitar and actually make money doing it.
And make money for doing it.
That kind of set me on a path to be a professional musician.
Gotcha. And parents were all supportive with you going out and playing?
Up to a point.
Okay.
I mean, they were, as long as I got my schoolwork done, I think the fact that I was making money doing it.
Right.
And that was, that kind of gave it legitimacy. But I wasn't so busy doing it that, my dad had a shop, so I could help him out in the shop sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Sit in the back room and practice and entertain him. And so there was, my dad, I think, kind of understood. They still thought that I should be, a doctor or
a proper job.
Got you. So were you enjoying electric and acoustic guitar? Even?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. I got my second guitar was an arch top, like a jazz style guitar with a cutaway. And I got a pickup for that, and I got a Selma Little Giant amplifier, and which was 5 mighty watts.
Gotcha. Wow.
And then kind of graduated from that to a Watkins Dominator, which was 18 watts or 17, something like that. And then I got my first Stratocaster, first solid body would have been probably about 1966.
Okay, cool.
So, I was playing acoustic. I was learning classical guitar in high school.
Okay.
I wanted to study music. And in order to do that, I needed to get a certain grade level on an instrument so that, they won't let you study like O level or A level without having grade 6 or grade 8 or instrument. So, I studied classical and I enjoyed it, but I never really had any ambition to be a classical guitar player.
Okay.
Too much fun playing rock and roll.
Right. Well, it did come in handy throughout your career, though.
We'll add that I was fascinated by folk guitar. At that same period, the Beatles were a little bit kind of behind the curve when it came to incorporating more of the folk elements.
Okay.
Whereas, 63, we have Bob Dylan, Joan Baez.
Right.
And protest songs. And then, it starts filtering into rock and roll. But it wasn't really, the kind of folky picking stuff that I was listening to, a little bit of that with Paul and Yesterday, but really White Album era Beatles.
Yeah.
And that was really Donovan teaching him stuff in Indy.
Right, stuff like Blackbird.
Yeah, but Blackbird has its roots in Bach.
Okay,
Guitar accompaniment. I mean, that was something that Paul and George had learned this Bach Bourée. When you see Paul in concert, he plays a little bit of it before he plays Blackbird.
Gotcha.
But I was curious as to where they learned it.
Okay.
Because George, I talked to George when I worked with him back in the 80s, and he talked about having a jazz guitar teacher.
Gotcha.
And you could see in his chord shapes, but you watch the Ed Sullivan Show, and he's not playing cowboy chords, he's playing adult chords.
Did you feel being trained classically helped you, or did you want to just be a straight rocker from the outset?
I wanted to be I wanted to be a professional guitar player. So what that meant in terms of style, the style wasn't the primary thing. I didn't want to be, I wasn't out there to be a rock and roll guitar player. I wanted to make a living being a guitar player. I loved, as part of the picture, as part of the job description, was to be a lead guitar player. So my influences beyond George Harrison more so in terms of Clapton and Hendrix and Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck, for example. Oh,
got you.
But also jazz guitar players. I mean, I was really not stuck in any one particular style, but the classical training, especially as time went on and I went to college and studied like music, that gave me the ability to understand musical style and deconstruct it in a way that I could then reconstruct it from a guitaristic point of view.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And those skills I've never lost.
That's yeah.
What
yeah.
you do as a player really relies on that ability to listen to music and understand it. Yeah. At the same time, I mean, one of the more satisfying things that I do is to be able to, crank up the Stratocaster and
right
play some lead guitar. Yeah. So,
how long did that music degree from Goldsmiths take? Was that a 4-year thing?
No, that's England at the time. I don't know if it's changed, but then it was a 3-year because you have longer semesters and just different. When I was studying, all the general education stuff is already done when you're in high school. Mm. So I did nothing but study music. I studied music theory and I studied musicology. I was taking some classical guitar lessons privately, and I was teaching guitar.
Oh, wow.
But, I just, the kind of extension course type classes. But,
gotcha.
But generally... for me, my music education was actually kind of on the gig, playing in a band, playing with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, and really having that hands-on ears paying attention.
You also learned how to play the lute while you were there, correct?
Yeah, I did. Let me show you. I'll show you a lute.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow.
Now, I have seen...
the reproduction of a Renaissance lute.
Okay.
It's the mandolin on steroids thing.
It certainly looks like a mandolin on steroids.
Now, I've seen one. We, here in Arizona, we got that great musical instrument museum.
Oh, I love that place. I've played.
Yeah, so you've been in the Meme before? Been to the Meme?
Oh, yeah, I've played there like 4 or 5 times.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. I live 10 minutes from there. So, great place.
I know that neighborhood.
Yeah.
So lute is really kind of the root of like finger picking guitar. What we call classical guitar really has its roots in Renaissance. And during the 16th century, the lute was kind of one of the dominant instruments because keyboards were fairly rudimentary then.
Gotcha.
And with the lute, you could play harmony, you could play melody, you could, they improvised on it. But by the end of the 16th century, they started adding more strings and the necks got longer and longer. And keyboards got more sophisticated, and music in general changed from being kind of chord progressions and melodic figuration. The bass lines became much more important.
Gotcha.
In the Baroque era. So, and that thing that for me was always a thing because I learned a lot about music from listening to the radio. Mm. And in particular, we have Radio Luxembourg,
sure,
which was kind of almost like a pirate radio station as far as they played a lot of American Top 40.
Gotcha.
And then the BBC also had like jazz broadcasts, and I'd lie in bed and I'd listen to all the like new Motown stuff. Right. And I remember Carol King, "It Might as Well Rain Until September," and stuff.
None of that stuff would be on the light program.
Not on the light program. No. Then I would kind of tune into the BBC and they'd have, they'd be playing Louis Armstrong and Jack Teagarden or Django Reinhardt and stuff like that. And so, and then I started buying records of stuff that kind of appealed to me. And I discovered Bach. There was a, remember, there was a record, you wouldn't remember originally, but you may be aware of a group called The Toys had a song called Lover's Concerto, which was a hit right about 64 or so. And that was based on a Bach keyboard piece. And so, okay, well, who's this Bach guy? And then and then I started learning Bach on classical guitar, and then it just kind of, and that's all about, you know, that kind of mature Baroque music is all about moving bass lines and counterpoint and stuff that is kind of real meat and potatoes music theory.
Gotcha.
And of course, with jazz, you know, getting deeper into harmony and how all of that just became kind of musical inspiration.
Gotcha. So graduation then, I mean, how soon is it then you start becoming a sessions player, you know, working in the studio and...
Well, nowadays in England, they have what they call the gap year, where you take like a year between high school and university. Mm-hmm. I was a pioneer of the gap year. I got accepted at, there was a college in Leeds in the north of England, Leeds College of Music, which was the only place where you could study something along the lines of jazz guitar and studio kind of stuff, like, kind of like Berklee School of Music in Boston.
Sure.
And they accepted me there, but then I got my A levels and I got like an A in music, which everybody had told me I would never get, and I did. And it was like, then it was like, okay, well, here's the thing. I've been paying my dues around London. Why do I want to leave?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What I did was I took a gap year and I applied to University of London, of which Goldsmiths College is one of the constituent colleges. And that way I could be in town and I was gigging. I mean, I was making money. I was playing, you know, whatever the gigs were. I used to play at a place called the Gresham Ballroom. It was an Irish ballroom in North London. And then I got accepted at Goldsmiths and, you know, basically, I mean, things didn't really change that much for me. I just transitioned into being in that kind of college environment, but still gigging.
Right. Was that allowed, LJ? Because I know that Elton John went to the Royal Academy of Music and sort of Rick Wakeman, they could not work and go to school at the same time.
Different. A conservatory environment's different.
Okay.
In a conservatory environment, they would frown on anything outside of the classical paradigm. Whereas, you know, where a Goldsmith's, Stanley Glasser, who was my professor there, who was a South African composer, was a jazz guitar fan. So he kind of mentored me. And at one point, I mean, after my second year, I got a gig. I was playing over the summer. I was playing in the band, the pit band of a musical in the West End. A show called Let My People Come.
Okay.
It's kind of like O Calcutta.
Yeah.
And I never saw the show because I was always like, you know, in the pit.
In the pit playing.
And I'd been doing things like Jesus Christ Superstar. You know, I'd go and sub in that or Hair or... You know.
Sure. All the big shows of the day.
So, you know, because I could sight read. So,
yeah.
You know, and I could follow a conductor and all of that. So...
Gotcha.
I had this gig and I was thinking about not going back to school, and, you know, Stanley, you know, kind of basically read me the riot act and said, all this means is, you know, a contractor, and you'll know plenty of contractors. So just, you know, it's not that much longer, finish your degree and then go into it. So I did.
Great.
And, but at that time, I was playing with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, too. And so we would go out and do, like, you know, short tours and stuff. But it always worked out in relation to college work.
Gotcha.
And, you know, for my final year, I mean, I don't think I submitted a single essay. I think I did most of the academic work in the first 2 years. And then the final year was just preparing for final exam.
Okay.
And
gotcha.
But you know, it was just making myself kind of indispensable to various people around town, so that by the time I left, I was going straight into studio work.
Okay.
Right. Seamless transition. Yeah, just go right from school right into work.
I mean, it wasn't like I was doing full-time sessions. I mean, one of the first gigs I got after I graduated was with Ray Ellington. Are you a fan of The Goon Show?
We know it, but I don't think I've heard any.
One of the, like a guest musical artist on The Goon Show. And, okay. And he would do these kind of very cool bebop kind of arrangements of kind of sometimes novelty songs. But he was very hip, played percussion and sang. And right. His son Lance is actually a top studio singer in England these days.
Gotcha.
But you know, so I was doing that gig but also getting session work, and then and I was kind of cool, you know, to use the old vernacular. I was quite chuffed to get that gig. One of my predecessors in that band was John McLaughlin, for example.
Wow.
Okay.
John McLaughlin. So right. I felt like I was kind of on the right path.
Okay. So I would imagine then once you get a gig with, Cleo Lane with George Martin, you must have been thinking, okay, I've made it.
You know, I mean, I'll get a decent session now and I think, oh, I've almost made it. It's the curse of being a freelance musician is that you never quite know where the next gig is coming from. You know, the fact that one of my earlier sessions was with, you know, the Cleo Lane with George Martin producing was great. I mean, it was a great experience. And I got, you know, to work with the Beatles producer and how
right.
that.
Exactly.
But it was, you know, it was kind of one project in the midst of other projects. And, you know, I would go from a jingle session at 8 a.m. Maybe at Olympic to Abbey Road for a 10 o'clock session, you know, for a record, and then over to Trident and then to the BBC in the evening or whatever. So when it got to the point where I was doing multiple sessions a day, it was like, okay, now, you know, this is the real deal.
I'm actually gotcha. Doing this. Gotcha. So let's talk Bond for a second. You know, how does a gig like that just, you know, pop in your lap?
All part of that same continuum. The first contractor that really adopted me was a man named David Katz, mm-hmm. who was a violin player. And he worked with a lot of artists. I mean, I think Elton John put the strings on a lot of the early Elton John records.
And, uh-huh.
and okay. he called me up and said, you know, I want to get you started on sessions. He'd seen me on television with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra. And as it turned out, the first sessions that he gave me coincided with my final exams. So I had to take it down. But eventually, you know, he called me back. I thought I'd never hear from him again, but he called me back and you know, he got me started. And then other contractors started using me.
Gotcha.
But David was the contractor for the Spy Who Loved Me
right.
soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a whole bunch of sessions for that. We did sessions for the movie with Marvin Hamlisch, but also for the record, for the track album.
Gotcha. So you could be heard in the movie and on the soundtrack as well?
Oh yeah, I mean the first thing you hear in the first music you hear in the movie
right.
is the Bond thing just on solo guitar. Right. That's me.
Oh wow!
But I also we for the album we did an arrangement of Nobody Does It Better instrumentally with piano, sax, electric guitar, and strings. And I didn't know until a few years ago that was actually nominated for an Academy Award.
Oh, wow.
That version. Wow.
That version.
That would have been nice to have known.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't know about these things sometimes.
Right.
But But during that session, and I had long forgotten this until I was reminded also quite recently, there was a point where they said, you know, we need some guitar licks on this. And they ran about, I don't know, like a couple of minutes worth of track by me just to kind of put some licks into. And, it, you know, so I did it and then forgot all about it. And then it was like, well, you know, that was like the write out of Nobody Does It Better. Simon Records.
Sure.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, you do things. I mean, I didn't know that I'd played on Alan Parsons Project's Tale of Mystery and Imagination until I read it in a magazine 25 years
ago. Wow. I mean, that just means like you're just so busy that you...
Yeah, and you don't always know what it is you're playing on.
Right. Gotcha.
Because in America, it's a little different because the union sessions here... Right. You know, you'll get reuse. I'll get reuse from things, and it'll say, you know, like let's say a particular TV show. But even then, there are TV shows that I'd played on a thing for one TV show gets used on another show, and all of a sudden I'm looking and seeing, well, wait a minute, I didn't know I played on that.
Right.
So do you recall playing on the Muppet Movie soundtrack then?
Oh yeah, well that was more recent, and that was, you know, that was playing banjo for Kermit and
right.
Like
gotcha.
That.
Did you get to meet Paul Williams?
On many occasions. Paul Williams has actually been in this very studio. I mean,
nice. You know, you when know,
I first worked with Paul in 1988, thereabouts, when we worked on the songs for the soundtrack to Ishtar.
Right. Okay.
The ill-fated Ishtar movie,
mm-hmm.
which. The album that we recorded never actually got released because the movie got panned, you know.
So. Right.
But Paul wrote some amazing songs. And then after he had got sober and kind of started reinvigorating his career, I did a few projects with him. We did an album for Japan because the Carpenters had been so big in Japan and people
wrote
songs. We did.
Did you work on the
DVD
on the...
audio? Actually, we did a DVD audio that Willie Nelson guested on too.
Oh wow!
But the funny story is that Paul came over here because we were there was a documentarian that wanted to make a movie about the late Paul Williams.
Yeah, I'm still alive. I just watched that again. I love that documentary. Great
stuff. Yeah, but the guy didn't know that Paul was still alive.
Oh, God.
So they wanted a song for the end credits. So
right.
Paul contacted me and said, can we do this together? So he came over and it was just me and him. Just
beautiful song.
Voice. Yeah. And we worked it out here in the studio, and then they said, "Well, can we add a string quartet? But we don't have any money. Do a guitar quartet. Because it won't, you don't have to pay me anymore." So I did. So that's how it worked out with kind of these multiple guitars on this
gotcha.
Track. But I thought that turned out quite nice. I mean, Paul's so vulnerable and so much. Kind of like really from the heart, that was
right.
A cool thing.
It was amazing, you know, just looking back at all the things I remember watching in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s that he did, and just like a, you know, reminder. Good stuff, good stuff.
Yeah, a great songwriter.
Yeah.
But if you ever find any of the songs that he wrote for Ishtar.
Okay.
There's a few of them floating around, and there's like a society of people who love that movie and love, you know, getting together and singing the songs.
Gotcha.
And somewhere on a cassette in a box in record producer Michael James Jackson's house,
yeah.
Somewhere nice. there are actual like
right.
tracks of, you know, of that. Of those songs.
So let's jump in now to David Essex show. You're playing there, and that's when you first meet Denny Lane, correct?
Right. Interesting progression, but I had been working as the lead guitarist on that show, the David Essex show. And from 1 week to the next, we had different guests.
Right.
The one week was Twiggy. Mm. There's a very cool version on YouTube of Send in the Clowns with
Twiggy.
David Essex and Twiggy doing a duet. And then okay. we had Ronnie Spector. Where the Say Goodbye to Hollywood was a single that she put out, and we came on the show and did it. And then Denny Lane came on and did Go Now, and he liked my playing. Mm. And apparently he called up Richard Niles, the musical director, and said, is he versatile? He is. But there was an interesting progression that happened, because that summer, that was September of 77.
Okay.
That happened. But in August, the previous month, I had been on a transcendental meditation retreat with Mike McCartney.
Right. Okay.
Michael.
Yes.
And one morning, Mike comes into the room waving a newspaper declaring that Elvis had died. So I learned that Elvis had died from Mike McCartney.
Wow. Yeah, and August.
Denny Lane not long after. And then I was at a session at CTS Studios in Wembley with Herbie Flowers, who's one of the great studio bass players. Mm-hmm. And we were on our Musicians Union 15-minute break on our session and went off to the men's room, and there's Paul McCartney zipping up his fly. A very inauspicious meeting with Paul.
Right.
And then not long after that, I was doing a session. I went to Air Studios to do it in Oxford Circus to do a session. And Paul and Linda and Denny were in the studio running a bit late, and I was early. Mm-hmm. They invited me in. I think they were working on like the Oriental Night Fish or one of those animations.
Right.
And that was when I got to meet the three of them as a band.
Right.
But it wasn't until the following April, that I was working at Abbey Road in Studio 2, again, at kind of an auspicious place to be. And a phone call for me, which was very unusual. I mean, studio musicians didn't get phone calls like that.
Gotcha.
But we took a break, and I went up, and I'd not been in the control room before. Went up the stairs.
Oh, at number two, yeah.
And into the control room, and the phone was just on the other side. And it was Alan Crowder at MPL saying, Denny wants to know if you can come and jam on Monday. And oh, by the way, Paul and Linda will be there.
Oh, wow.
So as it happened, I was available. If I wanted, I would have made myself available.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And I didn't have any Wings albums, so I borrowed some albums from my brother. I hadn't really been listening. I mean, the most recent hit had been Mull of Kintyre.
Right.
Sure.
Which you had to have been dead to not have heard that song. I would imagine.
That song. And then, but London Town, not London Town, With a Little Luck had just come out.
Right, in the 70s, fall, spring of 78, right, yeah.
And I remember seeing a video. I was working on a TV show in Manchester, and they showed the video. I think it was for With a Little Luck. Mm-hmm. But something in me tells me that it was the London Town video. But according to Steve Holly, that wasn't shot until April.
Yeah, because it's weird because, you know, you can see Steve in the With a Little Luck video, and then you see both of you in the I've Had Enough video.
Enough video was later, that's why.
Right.
Right. But then we've got
the I've Had Enough video in Scotland at the end of May of 17. Mm-hmm. So okay. Steve and I think it was like April 22nd or something that we both auditioned and got the gig.
Right. Because then...
Basically, I fit the suit.
Because then the third video, London Town, which is then by that time you guys are both in the band, but then we don't see you guys in that video.
So yeah, but that London Town video was actually shot earlier.
That's okay, all right, gotcha.
But we did. I mean, we were up in Scotland just for like 2 or 3 weeks in May, just kind of getting to know each other.
Gotcha.
Doing a lot of jamming.
Mm-hmm. Really, right.
I don't recall doing any actual recording.
This was in Root Studio, LJ?
Yeah, this was up on the farm.
Yeah.
Which is basically, you know, a barn that had been converted. Right. Actually, when there was like a kind of what became kind of like a rec room area that we were actually in to begin with. And then when we went back in July to actually start work on Back to the Egg, the barn had been converted into the studio.
Gotcha. Ah. Yeah. Andy, you want to start?
Above all of that, above the rec room area, there was like a dormitory type thing.
Gotcha.
Where we were sleeping.
Okay. So then I think I've heard you in past interviews say that same time next year was your first session with the band?
Yeah, the first session, which was early May, was the same time next year.
Mm. Which and ended up not getting used
demo,
for
the film. That was a demo that Paul did for the movie.
Okay, right.
He did a demo for the movie, but you know, I mean, I'd never worked on a demo that had, you know, had a 60-piece string orchestra. The strings were done later. I couldn't be there for the string session because I still had gigs in the book that I had to like finish up before I could be full-time available. But I remember there was an arranger named Fiacre Trench who did the strings on that. And I think I had recommended him because I'd
worked. Okay. Gotcha.
So at this point, LJ, so you've been like working freelance and doing your own thing. How did it feel to then actually go into a band? Was it something you were ready for at your career at that point to say, okay, I'm going to jump at this opportunity? Or?
Well, in terms of life experience, I think yes, because you know my father had passed away suddenly in March. And then a month later, I get asked to join Wings. And it's like, okay, my life is changing. And so I was certainly ready to be in a position where I could be focused in the way that was required for being in Wings. Because, you know, the thing about being a studio player is you walk into the session and, you know, you've got a three-hour session and you're going to probably cut three tunes. Mm. And whereas, you know, with Wings, it was like, you know, we spend a day or more. So a little different. But I think that, you know, I've always found it in my career and, you know, to some extent in the music business that things tend to go in like 3-year cycles. Mm. So I had kind of like left college and done this kind of 3-year cycle of studio player. And then I'm in Wings for 3 years.
Right.
Then I'm, you know, then things kind of change beyond that.
Right.
But basically, yeah, I was ready for it.
Okay. Cool.
I kind of wish that we had done more live playing earlier on.
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
And I also wish that we had done kind of work quicker in the studio, so that as a band we could have a faster momentum going.
Right. And that was going to be my next question, because you talked about doing like 3-hour sessions and doing three songs. And all of a sudden now you're this album takes a year to record. And was that frustrating for you at any point?
Well, I mean, there's always a frustration when you're working on projects that are slow. Because I like doing things quickly. You know, added up all of the time I actually spent contributing to that record.
Right.
In terms of actual playing time, I mean, you could probably fit it quite neatly into a week or so.
Mm. Wow, crazy.
But the thing is that there was also a great opportunity to learn, because I got to watch the process. Mm. I got to see how things were being mic'd up, to, you know, to learn from Chris Thomas's experience.
Yeah.
You know, Phil McDonald or Jeff Emmerich, or you know, Jeff didn't really work on Back to the Egg, but he was on other stuff that we did.
Right.
And you know, so there was that sense of it being a continuing education.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because one of my favorite things that we did during that time period was the Rupert demo.
Right.
Sure.
And that's the question.
One day.
Right. So were you a Rupert fan growing up then?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
So all that Rupert work was done in one day, you said?
Well, some of the stuff Paul had already, like,
yeah, when the wind is, when
the, all the overdubs and
sure
newly recorded tracks were all, you know, it was just basically a day's work. I mean, you can hear the piano gradually going out of tune, you know, as we
right.
Gotcha. The fast pace, I mean, Paul's work habit, or work, I mean, workaholic, I mean, all that stuff, fast pace. I mean, talk about that for a minute. Is, you know, was it a bit daunting? Or, I mean, was it, you know, how did...
Because you like to work fast, so you probably enjoyed his work ethic.
I like to work.
Right.
Right.
And Paul likes to work. You know, I don't really consider him to be a workaholic. Okay. As much as just having a tremendous work ethic.
Mm.
You know, I mean, the fact that within a week of him getting out of jail in Japan, he was back in the studio. Mixing the live Glasgow stuff.
With right. Just,
you know, right. It's like the work is, you know, when you're an artist, the work is what you do. And it's how you kind of, how you delineate between family time and mm-hmm. creative time is you just, you know, you have this context where, you know, I come out here into my studio and I'm working.
Right.
And I can do it whenever I want.
And you can switch off whenever you like. Right.
Yeah. So the challenge that Paul gave you guys for the B-side for Goodnight Tonight, what was your contribution to that?
Well, you see, first of all, it wasn't a B-side.
Okay.
Ah.
What had happened was we had a meeting
okay.
in like this conference room
mm-hmm.
with like little notepads and glasses of water and, you know, right. like, you know, and a kind of a conference table. And it was, okay, we need a single.
Mm.
So Paul didn't want to pull something off of the album. So we need a single. And it might have been me, said, well, what did you do in the Beatles when you needed a single? And said, we write one over the weekend. So my recollection is, you know, we'll go write one over the weekend.
Right.
You know, apparently there was something competitive about it, but because it wasn't defined as a B-side, because it wasn't until we had cut the track and then finished up Goodnight Tonight that the A-side, B-side thing really came into contention.
Gotcha.
Because I mean, Daytime Nighttime Suffering was just a tremendous song.
It was, yeah.
But when, you know, when we went into the studio the following Monday morning, we were in replica. We were in, you know, in the basement of Soho Square.
Mm, right.
With a replica of the control room of that.
Yes.
Now, we hadn't intended to record. We were mixing. Because Cliff Richard had, you know, had Abbey Road booked, so we were mixing there.
Okay.
And, the issue was that Paul came in and said, I want to record it now. So there was this little kitchenette area, and the drums were set up in the kitchenette, and we're all kind of like, you know, like squeezed into this little space. Mm-hmm. And we cut the track and worked on it that week and also did some overdubs on Goodnight Tonight. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly when it was decided that Goodnight Tonight would be the A-side.
A-side, gotcha.
It was a timely choice
mm.
because dance music was doing very well on the charts.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, notwithstanding the fact that Columbia Records insisting on describing the 12-inch as a disco single, it was a dance record.
Right,
exactly.
A huge hit in, you know, in the European discos that summer when it came out. I mean, that was, you know, a big deal. Right. And, you know, still, I mean, it was a top 10 record in America.
Of course, yeah. When did you bring...
Some of the radio stations played Daytime, Nighttime, Suffering. They thought Goodnight Tonight was too disco.
Oh, really?
Listen to the live version of it from the Glasgow concert on the last mm-hmm. flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, sounds like Spanish dance rock.
Yeah, it does. With the programming, the robot machine that he was using.
Well, yeah, that was just a gag.
Yeah.
It was a drum, you know, it was one of the, you know, the early drum machines on the
Yeah.
When did you bring Maisie into the picture?
That was in July of 78 when we were up in Scotland, and Linda wasn't there that day, and Paul said, "You got a tune?" And I said, "Well, I got this, you know, this little instrumental." Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of set up in a circle and recorded it.
Gotcha.
And then I think Paul just forgot all about it.
Could we expect to see that on a Back to the Egg archive box set?
I have no idea. I have no idea what's going on with the archive. I mean, that's available on my standard time.
Fine, right.
Of the digital reissue of that, which was never, I mean, the original 12-inch that I did was an EP. It didn't have all the tracks I'd recorded, but when last year or whenever it was, when you know, I released it all on my own label, and
gotcha.
And that stuff, I mean, the high resolution, but you know, that stuff was actually being used in trade shows to demonstrate hi-fi equipment.
So
a few times in my career, because I get involved in things that are like really high-end, you know, high-end recording.
Right. So let's talk about, I know we're getting going long on time, but let's talk about that transition then into a solo career. You know, Wings is officially done. And was this an MPL production, the Standard Time LP?
Yeah, because that was done in September, well, over the summer, and finished up in September of 79.
Okay.
That coincided with, you know, that I was mixing it while we were rehearsing for the tour.
Oh, so
we do like, which, you know, all-night mixing sessions and then go and do a tour rehearsal.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah. On a question on that too, LJ, there's some footage out there. You can see you guys rehearsing for the tour, and I know With a Little Luck was in contention to be played. Did you think that would translate well live?
It didn't. That's why we didn't do it. The fact is that the band, as it had developed, was really had more in common with the rock side of Back to the Egg than the softer side of Back to the Egg. I mean,
gotcha.
You know, I felt like the rock side of it, you know, with the old Siam's spin it on, you know, to you, was kind of like pushing the boundaries a little bit, whereas the other stuff, you know, was not that different from what I would have played on a regular session, you know.
Sure.
You know, Winter Rose and things like
that. Right, Love Awake.
And of course, you know, with Love Awake, I played bass. So that was a little different because that's my debut as a bass player on a record.
Right.
Coached by you know, Sir Paul himself.
Winning a Grammy must have been pretty exciting.
It wasn't because we didn't know we'd won it.
Oh, jeez.
That, you know, after we got back from Japan, mm-hmm. what happened was when Back to the Egg came out was when I first really started kind of making connections in New York.
Okay.
We were in Japan and, you know, the tour didn't happen and they didn't want us to stay very long. So after like 3 days or so, you know, I went to L.A. and I was working on some of my connections there and then went back to London and, you know, back in London. And one day this little box arrives in the mail and I open it up and there's this thing inside and you had to screw it together. And it was like, wait a minute, this is a Grammy. We had no idea.
Wow.
Well, you know, nobody told the band. I mean, I imagine Paul would have known, but right. Nobody told us. So that time around wasn't exciting. The next time was more exciting because it was expected.
Sure.
Got you. The transition to, well, first of all, you also wrote for Club Sandwich as well.
Well, you know, that was Club Sandwich was like Linda's project.
Okay.
And she came to me and said, "You want to write something?" So I did this Lawrence's Guitar Corner kind of thing. You know, I'd never written anything like that before, so I just kind of went for it.
Was it that more like a note instructional guide on, you know,
playing guitar? No, it was like, you know, just talking about the guitars and
kind
of how sessions went and stuff like that. Cool. I don't remember much about it. I mean, you know, I'm sure there are people with, you know, the complete Club Sandwich collections. And I've got I got most of them, but they're all in boxes.
Yeah, yeah.
You played on my favorite Linda track, Love's Full Glory. Do you remember working on that? And plus, you know, Lloyd Green, his work on that was just incredible as well.
Yeah, that was fun. That was when we were in France working on Stuff and Smell the Roses with Ringo. Right. Mm-hmm. That was when we cut that track. That's why Ringo's playing drums on it.
Okay. Gotcha.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent song.
I believe so. I mean, I don't remember him not playing drums on it.
So that's like 1980?
Yeah.
July 1980.
All right, so then another...
Boy, they actually brought Lloyd Green in because we were doing Sure to Fall.
Mm-hmm. The old song, right, yeah.
Right. Carl Perkins song. And you know, Lloyd was one of the top
steel pedal
players in Nashville. Yeah. So he came in, you know, this was in the south of France. He came in from Nashville and it was me, Paul, Ringo, and Howie Casey.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah. So one more Wikipedia fact or fiction. So then Lloyd Green turned down a chance to play for a proposed U.S. tour?
News to me.
Okay. Yeah, I just saw that written somewhere, and I thought,
The idea of a U.S. tour had been floating around. The idea of doing more tour dates after Japan, but Japan just kind of put the brakes on it all.
Gotcha. And,
you know, the sad thing is that were we to have done a U.S. tour in the summer of 1980, would have been with a number one single.
Mm. Certainly, yeah.
Much to chagrin, of course, because, you know, he'd put all of his energy into the studio version.
Right.
And, you know, done that cool video and debuted it on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
But radio wasn't going for it until they realized that there was a live version on the B-side.
From Glasgow that they edited down and just threw it in the album anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, because, you know, CBS realized that people were buying the album expecting to hear what they were hearing on the radio. Mm.
Right.
Gotcha.
So, but I think that kind of exemplifies what had happened was that you have Paul going off. I mean, yeah, you know, McCartney 2 has this kind of quirky experimental aspect to it. Mm-hmm. But heading into Tug of War, that you have Wings had developed this kind of rock and roll thing.
Right.
Right.
Core of me, Danny, and Steve. But the Tug of War material was pop.
Yes, and we're
rehearsing
true.
It in the kind of rehearsal room circumstance that you would do if you were doing a rock band, but the tunes that really needed to be worked on in the studio.
Gotcha. And there's so many rehearsals of you all working on that material. It's on YouTube. I mean, just take after take of Average Person and Keep Undercover. Look at the air. Look at the
We were just fooling around, just trying stuff. I mean, they're really not takes.
Right. Okay. Just learning them.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there was a fair amount of just kind of jamming and, you know, but the reality of it was that, you know, they didn't need a band at that point.
Right. Right.
You know, George Martin gets involved. The songs don't need a band to be properly articulated.
Right.
And I, you know, in January of 81, after we had spent a few weeks working on the Cold Cuts material. In fact,
right.
One of the last things I did was put some slide guitar on A Love For You.
Right, which is the only Wings track to feature two Wings guitarists or two Wings drummers on that. I can't remember the significance of that track.
But I don't remember. I mean, well, that's a Ram outtake. Mm.
Right.
So technically, whatever was on there, I mean, yeah, if Denny Seiwell played drums,
right,
you know, then it would have been kind of multi-Wings generation.
Right, right.
I don't recall that Steve put any more drums on that.
Okay.
But, you know, because the, you know, Hugh McCracken could have been a Wing, but...
Right.
Turned it down, yeah.
You know, and it's that thing that, you know, do you give up a valuable studio career or do you go and work with Paul McCartney? And in my case, it was that nanosecond of, am I going to give up my studio career or am I going to work with Paul McCartney? And here I am. So, what happened was that I moved to New York at the end of January 81.
Mm-hmm.
And started working on some projects there and got involved in session work very quickly. And then in April, you know, Wings officially folded on April 27th.
Okay. Yeah.
Denny left.
Yeah.
Right.
I met Hope April 28th.
Right. So then then not too long after, you started working on TV shows, themes for...
Well,
TV
that
shows.
Was, first of all, I had to move from New York to L.A.
Okay. Gotcha.
We got engaged, and then we got married in March of 82.
Okay.
And I think one of the first sessions I did was, it might have been for a Herbie.
Okay.
Movie. It's funny that you mentioned before those life changes, right? It's a big event happens, another which predecessors another one, so it all happens for a reason, as you say.
So, yeah, I seriously started getting into session work in L.A. in 82. Mm.
Okay. The list is...
And it never stopped.
Yeah. Here we are.
The list is long. I mean, you're looking at The Facts of Life, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, you know, Eight Simple Rules, Home Improvement, Dinosaurs.
Roseanne.
Roseanne. And then at the same time, you're also doing music for soundtracks as well, like the Big
Chill. That was all part of the same scene. I mean, you know...
Okay.
You know, Cartage would, you know, take my equipment from one studio where I'd do a TV session and then to another studio where I'd be doing a record date or a movie date. And you know, so there were just, you know, a lot of sessions. Plus, I was also on camera for 4 years on The Young and the Restless playing.
Oh, that's right. How did you like that?
You know, it was an after a gig. I got health insurance through it.
Gotta have that.
I even get a minuscule pension from it too. You know?
Did they give you a Screen Actors Guild card too?
No, that was after because it was videotape.
Oh, okay.
Got you.
You know, at that time, they were two separate unions.
Oh, okay.
So I was in, you know, and the higher prevailing scale, if it was AF of M or whether it was after, you know.
Right, right.
That one. But we had to have like words, you know.
Right.
Like,
sure.
So then,
smoking Danny.
So in 1990, you started your solo career again with Solo Flight.
With Solo Flight.
Yeah. Talk about that.
I'd been writing a lot of tunes during that period. You know, I had little kids. I didn't want to travel. I was doing a lot of session work.
Right.
A friend of mine who I'd done some writing with, James Lee Stanley, who's a wonderful kind of folk singer, songwriter, had a record label, and we were working on a radio show called Folk Scene, which was on KPFK, which is a local public radio station. And I started noodling around on a little piece that I'd been working on, and James said to me, you know, I have a record label. I'd like you to do an album for me.
Ah, okay.
So I did, like, the summer of 1990, I recorded the Solo Flight album mm-hmm. that came out and actually got some radio airplay.
Now, did you go in owning your own material? Like oh, yeah. Paul owns his material
yeah,
as well?
Yeah, I had no publishing deal with anybody. And the first okay. batch of albums were almost exclusively original material.
Mm-hmm.
Until
right.
I did Winter Guitar, which was a Christmas album. And
right. Well, you worked on a lot of Christmas albums, I've noticed.
Well, I've worked a lot of Christmas albums with other people. Well, you got to
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Christmas music is 25% of the music business.
Oh, wow.
That's an amazing that. Fact.
Yeah.
Wow.
One of the producers that I've done a lot of work with is Michael Lloyd.
Okay.
He was really kind of an old school Hollywood record producer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he produced You Light Up My Life for Debbie Boone and you know,
right.
Sean Cassidy and Leif Garrett and those kind of things. And he, you know, over the years, I mean, Andy Williams, Lou Rawls.
Wow.
Air Supply.
Yeah, Air Supply for Christmas.
a lot of Christmas records. And a lot of other things, too. I mean, I've done two or three albums with Sylvie Vartan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, huge in France.
Right. So when did you come up with the idea to start your work doing, you know, cover Beatles covers?
I yeah. didn't. It wasn't my idea. I mean, it was my wife's idea. And, and what happened was I had a few Beatle arrangements. And
okay.
I'd play them in concert and people liked them.
Mm-hmm.
But my focus was on being a guitar player and a composer.
You know, gotcha.
Composing my own stuff.
Sure.
So, you know, Solo Flight, Naked Guitar, LJ, Mosaic. The first four albums, there's, you know, Rain. I did a version of Rain on the Mosaic album, which then prompted more calls to do all Beatles and hopes right. that, don't do it for anybody else, do it for me. So I said, well, you produce it and I'll do it.
Right.
So that came out in, what, 2000? And
right.
was very well received and, you know, made it onto some kind of top 10 lists and stuff. And so that, you know, became a series. And in fact, you know, having done that, you know, and giving it to Paul and Paul said, well, what about Wings?
Yeah, that's my favorite one right there, that one.
Yeah, One Wing is a great record.
Thanks. And then it just, you know, it just became a thing, but not just Beatles. I mean, I really started to kind of find my voice as an arranger too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did an album of Harold Arlen tunes. I've got The World on Six Strings, you know, so Over the Rainbow and If I Only Had a Brain and Come Rain
Good
on
Sunshine,
stuff like that. Yeah. So, you know, and it just became kind of a balance between composing and arranging. And, you know, I think I've done like 30 albums now. Plus,
right.
I was also producing Al Stewart at the same time.
Right, right. So now you've done your fourth Beatles covers album, The Fab Fourth, and which was released, I think, in March earlier this year. So plans to continue that series, or are you going to retire doing...
I had no plans to do a volume two or a volume three or a volume four. So it's really up to Hope.
Gotcha.
Well, thank you, Hope.
have you been writing during the pandemic?
I have been mostly doing Facebook Live.
Yeah, that's true.
Facebook
yeah.
Live three times a week.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a lot of arranging.
Mm-hmm.
I have a little bit of writing, but believe it or not, I haven't had a lot of time to write. The writing that we have been doing this summer on the production side has been refining the score of the Brady Bunch musical that we did a reading in New York last year. And that got us a producer, and we now have a theater that interested in launching a tour. And we've got At the end of October, we're anticipating a Zoom style reading. And of course, you know,
gotcha.
That's the perfect environment for the Brady Bunch because of all the boxes.
The boxes. Right. Works perfect. That lends itself yeah. perfectly.
Yeah. Brady Bunch. So that's on the agenda. But most of my work with that is done. I've just got some production
gotcha.
Stuff to do. And, you know, just thinking about what the next album is going to be or albums.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem now is that CDs, really the most value in a CD is as show merchandise, but as I'm not anticipating there being any live concerts for at least another year.
Right,
which
yeah.
is just as
I used
a
to, I used
perform,
to be,
yeah.
Well, except
used,
the outdoors or streaming stuff.
Exactly, yeah. I used to be a tour caterer, so I worked a lot of concerts, and I have friends that are now hurting now because of the fact that there's no, you know, concerts going on.
A lot
so,
of people are hurting.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, but yeah, it's the drivers, the production teams, you know.
Oh, yeah. The entertainment business, you know, has kind of tendrils in many aspects of,
right.
of people's lives. And, you know, when you really start to analyze how much income has been lost.
Mm-hmm.
All of this. But I mean, I did a concert yesterday as part of an ensemble in Pasadena, that was outdoors. It was a backyard concert, and everyone
was
spaced, and there were plastic screens between me and singers, and I wore mm-hmm. my mask. And
right.
you know, I mean, it was it works to do an outdoor outdoor thing.
In a limited way, but at least it's something. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Last thing, can you talk about the book a little bit before we sign off?
Sure. Guitar with Wings. Do I have a copy of it around? No, I don't. So that came about because when I joined Wings, I had I bought a camera. I bought a decent camera because you know Linda was kind of an inspiration for that.
Right.
And I started taking pictures. So, you know, and of course you can't use flash. So it was a lot of black and white kind of, you know, high speed film stuff, fly on the wall kind of thing.
Mm.
Right.
And those pictures just sat in shoeboxes for like, you know, years.
Wow.
Until I was offered a book deal.
Oh, and wow.
So I spent like a year and a half going through them and scanning, and then I had to write, you know, a whole bunch of stuff.
So again, it wasn't necessarily your idea.
The centerpiece of the book is the back to the egg stuff, but it has career stuff too.
All right. But that's on your website now.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
You sell your CDs on your website as well.
I do.
Okay. Yeah. So anybody,
you know, there's also all my music is on Pandora and Spotify
streaming.
Okay.
Apple Music. Cool. And, you know.
Right. Well, thank you very much. This was a great great time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having
LJ,
me.
LJ, thank you so much, man.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Stay safe, stay well, and stay hydrated.
Yes.
Will do. Same to you. All the best now. Take care.
Yeah. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, there you go. That's LJ for you. That's the man. He has a good memory, let's say.
He certainly does. He can recall his dates and years very, very, you know. Like that. That was impressive. Great guy. What a nice man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he very generous with his time and very happy with that interview. So you know, hopefully you guys out there will be happy with it as well. So.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay. So for us, you know the deal. You can email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on YouTube, Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. If you like that, please subscribe to that. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. You can find us there. And our website, right?
Our website, yes. TwoLegsPodcast.com. Go to it.
Check it out. We'll have all the latest episodes up there as well. And look. Yes.
We love you, Lawrence. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Everybody out there, thank you very much. Andy, thank you very much. You know, this was a great back-to-back episodes, you know, two People that have spent a lot of time with McCartney
and worked with him, and Julian Mendelson in our last one, and then tonight with LJ. Just amazing job. Great on getting those guests and taking taking two legs onward and upward.
Absolutely. So everybody out there, you know the deal. Have a great day and a beautiful night. Take care.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan C.